It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the House Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to move the impeachment proceedings to the full House of Representatives. We'll learn more about this morning's vote and what to expect next week. First, an egg today is better than a hen tomorrow. That's wisdom that's been attributed to Benjamin Franklin. We're taking that quote to heart and cooking with eggs today for Food Friday. Our guest is a keeper of chickens himself, so he's had plenty of eggs to practice recipes with. David Tank is the Wisconsin-based author of Uncle Egbert's Egg Book, recipes and other fun ways to enjoy the eggs from your backyard chickens. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I am excited to be here.
I think there's a lot of that in the offing, right? A lot of egg-related puns?
Yeah, probably too many.
Now, before we get into what to do with eggs, let's go back to the source, your backyard chickens, and I guess which came first, your chickens or the egg recipes?
Well, the chickens definitely came first. We decided about 5 years ago to get some backyard chickens, which was fun, except then all of a sudden, you know, like 2 months later, we discovered we were starting to get a lot of eggs. We only had three hens, but that was turning into three eggs a day. There were only two of us in the household. Every 4 days, that's a dozen eggs. And you can, you know, give away just so many. And it was like, what do we do with all these eggs? So we started searching around for some interesting recipes because you get sick of just scrambled eggs pretty quick. And what could we do to use up all these eggs? And we started gathering recipes from different places. We started creating some of our own. And it just became a fun adventure on how do we get rid of so many eggs.
Yeah, eggs become the zucchinis of the animal world, I guess.
And we even have a recipe in there for egg-battered zucchini.
All right. Best of both worlds there.
You bet.
Now, you ended up with a wide variety of recipes in your book. I mean, you know, the basic scrambled, boiled, and so on, to burritos,
sure,
pizzas, soups, desserts, too. And a lot of these are your own originals or things you've modified, but you've also been on the hunt for, you know, those old cookbooks you find in thrift stores. What kind of inspiration have you found there?
Well, that was fun because searching through those, it was, some of them were very interesting, we'd never heard of, but the most fun part was trying to figure out how to make the recipes we found in those old church cookbooks work so that anybody could understand them. Sometimes we'd find them and it would say, like, make your batter as usual. And it's like, okay, that's not very helpful. Or some of them would be for, you know, like makes or serves 20. And it's like, no, we're not really wanting to serve 20, although that would use up a lot of eggs.
Now, let's talk about a couple of the basics before we dig into some specific recipes. I've heard conflicting advice over the years on the absolute best surefire way to hard-boil an egg. What is your favorite way to hard-boil eggs?
My favorite way to hard-boil an egg is really to bring it to the boil, to turn it off, let it sit for it's like 12 to 15 minutes, take it out. Why keep running the electricity on the stove for longer than you need to? And that seems to have worked fine. The biggest challenge is peeling the hard-boiled mm-hmm. eggs. That's a real bummer. In fact, I think it was on this program that I heard a guy last year talking about peeling eggs, and he says the most surefire way to peel a dozen hard-boiled eggs perfectly is to start with two dozen.
Perfect. And how about the scrambled eggs? I imagine you've eaten a scrambled egg or two since your chicken-raising experiment began. Any insight from that?
Well, you can do them in a microwave. It actually works
really
pretty well. And they're easy, and they taste good. They get nice and fluffy. You have to make sure you add a little water because the steam in there is what really makes them work. My preference is the old-fashioned way, where just in a frying pan, and you stir them as they fry. They're super simple. It's really fast. One of them, I actually had this for lunch today. Going through this book again today, I was thinking, well, now I'm hungry for eggs for lunch. So I had the old toad in a hole, which reminded me of being a Boy Scout, where you take the piece of bread, you cut a hole in the center, you put it in the frying pan with butter, and then as soon as it starts to get hot, you throw the egg in the center of it, then you flip it over, and you have your egg sandwich, but it's all in one piece, those eggs in the center of it. And that's kind of fun.
Talking to David Tank, Wisconsin-based author of Uncle Egbert's Egg Book, recipes and other fun ways to enjoy the eggs from your backyard chickens. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on this edition of Food Friday. Do you love eggs, like to cook with eggs? Do you need some advice? Or do you raise your own backyard chickens? Call 800-642-1234. Now, David, I love, should I be calling you Uncle Egbert, or is David okay?
David works for you.
Wonderful. Now, I like deviled eggs. I've never actually made them myself. You've got a recipe that you've shared with us. This is at WPR.org/Food Friday. Kick butt deviled eggs. Tell us about them.
Deviled eggs were something that I used to be known for bringing to potluck dinners. Although people seem today to be scared to eat deviled eggs or anything at a potluck dinner. It's like, oh my gosh, we hear eggs are going to be terrible and kill us. Not true. But I used to make a lot of them, and they're fun. They're easy. You just start out with some hard-boiled eggs. You take the insides out and mix it with a few things. I thought most deviled eggs were kind of bland, so I started adding some good Dijon mustard, some horseradish in it, some homemade pickle relish, and I ended up with great deviled eggs. I do have one thing that I would encourage people to remember, and I experimented with this as a big potluck one time. I put some dye in the yellow.
Really?
Yeah, I was thinking about the whole green eggs and ham thing.
Uh-huh.
And I put some red dye in one batch, and I put some blue dye, which turned green, in the other batch. And at the end of the potluck, none of the green eggs had been taken, and all of the red ones were gone.
They would not eat them at the potluck?
They were the exact same eggs, just a different color inside.
Did Dr. Seuss teach us nothing?
I guess not.
Now, do you do the paprika on top of those? That gives them a nice splash of color and flavor, too.
No, not usually.
Okay. I'm a big paprika fan. I probably would add that back to your recipe, if that's okay.
I added parsley flakes to this one. And if it's in the summer and you've got fresh parsley chopped up, that's pretty good.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Yep. I was just listening to, we grew chickens and had eggs, fresh eggs, and part of your peeling problem is your egg is so fresh. You need to let them age at least a week or so, and then after you hard boil them, they'll peel better.
Interesting. Yes. Have you experienced that too?
Yes, we have. That makes a big difference. In fact, we usually keep the eggs so we know which ones are the oldest ones. And it does seem like that works a lot better.
Well, I think we've got another bit of advice on peeling those hard-boiled eggs. Cindy is with us in Fifield. Cindy, hi.
Hi. What? Can you hear me?
Yeah. What's your advice on peeling hard-boiled eggs?
I used to work at a large hotel in Las Vegas, and we would peel dozens and dozens of eggs for banquets. And this is a surefire way to peel a hard-boiled egg. Once they're done, pour out the hot water, crack them, rinse them immediately in cold water. You can even rinse that again so the water is cold. Leave them in the cold, and then the water gets under the shell, and they'll slip out of that quite easily and whole. You won't destroy the egg.
And it doesn't make the egg soggy or anything, Cindy?
No, not at all. Not if they're completely hard-boiled and hard. No, it works like a charm.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call.
So you crack them before you put them in the cold water.
Yeah. So you put the cold water over the cracked eggs. Thank you so much for that advice, Cindy. That one I definitely want to try. Now, let's touch on another recipe you shared with us, a quiche. I like quiches in the holiday season. You can make them the night before and just reheat them. You gave us a ham, cheese, and broccoli quiche.
Yes.
Tell us about that one.
Quiche has really become our favorite go-to for the eggs, partly because it uses about 8 to 9 eggs in one batch if you use a deep dish crust. And they're really easy to make. The things that we discovered are the most important is, one, pre-bake your crust. Otherwise, it's really hard to get the crust not soggy. So I always pre-bake the crusts. Then I put the fillings in. And it has to bake for a long time. I was always too antsy to get to the thing. And it takes like 45 minutes to bake. And then the real key is, if you just take it out and cut it, it's going to look very juicy inside. It needs to sit for about another 15 minutes before you eat it. And then you can cut it, and it slices pretty good. But the first ones I made, I was always jumping the gun. I go, like, these things just are too liquidy. What's wrong?
I've got a quiche question for you, David. I've asked other guests. I've looked online. I can't find the answer. Sometimes when I make quiche, I get these patches on the top. I don't know if it's egg white or what, but there's these like tough, white, plasticky patches of the egg, I guess. Have you ever seen that? Do you know what causes that? Or is it all just
me? It sounds like you're using plastic Easter eggs.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it gives it that delightful color, David.
Yeah, right. And they crack right in half perfectly.
Exactly. Every time.
I don't know what that is, actually. Right. I have not run into that.
This is a Rob thing. We're talking to David Tank on Food Friday. He's the author of Uncle Egbert's Egg Book. We're talking about cooking with eggs. He's in our studio in Eau Claire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite egg dish? Do you have some tips for getting the perfectly fluffy scrambled egg? Or do you have a question for our guest about how he uses eggs? And do you, like our guest, raise eggs with your own chickens? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking about eggs with expert David Tank, Wisconsin-based author of the cookbook Uncle Egbert's Egg Book. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite way to cook and eat eggs, your own experiences maybe with backyard chickens yourself, or your questions for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls. Milan is with us in Spring Green. Milan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know, because you mentioned that you get those rubbery patches sometimes on top of your quiche.
Yes. Do you have an answer?
Yeah, so I make quiches a lot, and I don't know the 100% that my answer is right, but what I've found is that if I use the convection in my oven when I'm making a quiche, I get those. So if you turn the convection in your oven off, you should be able to avoid having those rubbery patches on the top.
Gotcha.
I know exactly what you're talking about there.
Okay.
Really kind of awful.
I don't have a convection oven, so I'll have to keep searching for an answer, but thanks for that. That's one possible cause. David, before we go back to our callers, talk about the experience of taking care of those backyard chickens a little bit.
Well, our chickens are definitely pets. Pets that earn their keep. they really are a lot of fun, and we've done various different things on how to keep them. We've had them free range for a while, but that didn't work so well because they also tend to like the same garden plants we do, which doesn't work so well. So we've got a nice large run for them. Occasionally we'll still leave them out and they'll follow us around in the yard. Probably the funniest thing that's ever happened with our chickens is that we had some company over. We were in the dining room, and the dining room has a patio door, and the chickens were outside on the deck watching us. And we were listening to Queen, my album of Queen, and the chickens were just out there pecking away. And all of a sudden, Bohemian Rhapsody comes on, and when they get to the break, the guitar break, the chickens stopped, put their heads to the glass, and were mesmerized until the guitar break was finished. And then they went back to their picking.
Right.
I guess they like that kind of picking.
I guess Dr. Brian May, yeah, he's a guitarist, yes, astronomer, and chicken whisperer as well.
And he's also a big 3D geek.
All right. Well, that's a great story. We'll go back to the callers now. Ron is with us in Los Angeles. Ron, hi.
Hi. I just happen to be David's brother.
Oh, okay.
No.
But I do happen to be calling you from Los Angeles. I am listening via the internet, and I wanted to remind him that my favorite recipe in that book, although there are a lot of good ones, is about French toast with granola. So please tell everybody how great that is.
Ah, okay. And you tested that recipe too, didn't you?
I tested that out before you got the book out.
That's right.
And I use that a lot.
Well, it's fancy French toast when you want to impress company, because you do the same thing as regular French toast, where you're dipping the bread in the egg milk mix and then frying it. The key is, before you put it on the griddle, I get some really good granola, like pistachio granola or something. I put it in the blender and I grind it really fine. Then the last thing I do is I dip the French toast, after it's been battered, into that mix, then put it on the griddle. and you get the loveliest, crunchiest outside to it, and the inside stays really well.
So. Ooh, that's another one I want to try. That sounds really good.
Yeah, that is a fun one, and easy, too.
All right, thanks a lot for the brotherly call from Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hello.
Hi. I'm going to go back to the woman who said that you run eggs under cold water. There is a less usury way to do that, and this is easy. When you put your eggs in the water for boiling, set up a side dish with some ice water in it, and you just dump the eggs. What happens, this is scientific, actually. There's a reason this happens. The steam from the inside of the eggs as it's cooling goes out in between the shell and the egg, and they will just pop right out of the shell. You just throw them from the hot water into the ice-cold water, and that works. You're not, like, running them under cold water. That just wastes a lot of water. Number two, old eggs are the best eggs to make soufflés with. Number three is that if you beat eggs whites and you put them in your non-rising bread dough, like you're making a quick bread with banana bread or whatever, it lifts the quality of the bread.
Chris, thank you so much for those three pieces of advice. I do that with my waffles, actually, where I'll whip egg whites and then fold them into the waffle batter.
Here's one other idea you might want to try on peeling the hard-boiled eggs. It's fun, and it's, I don't know, interesting when it works. Take your egg, put it in a jar, like a peanut butter jar, especially the glass one works good. Fill it about half full of water, and then just shake it. And the whole egg will get kind of pulverized, and when you dump it back out, you can just peel the pulverized egg right off the egg. And it works about 75% of the time, and if you shake too hard, you end up like with a really mushy mess in your jar. But it's fun.
All right, Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David Tank is with us on Food Friday. He's the author of Uncle Egbert's Egg Book, recipes and other fun ways to enjoy the eggs from your backyard chickens. Time for another caller or two. Peter is with us now in Chicago, or from Chicago. Peter, hi.
Hi. From Madison, Chicago. This is about preventing or making it easy to open eggs. I learned this from a Bulgarian cook, and we use it. It works. Before you put them in the hot water, you punch a little hole in the flatter end of the egg with I use a push pin, which we keep right with the eggs. You just put the hole in it, and sort of that exchange of hot water and cool water, whatever, they're easy to peel.
Anyway, I want to be clear on this, Peter. This is while the egg is still raw before the cooking process?
Yes.
Wow, okay. And it doesn't all start oozing out?
Sometimes a little tiny little stream will come out, but very little. It's a very small hole.
Well, the big end makes sense to do because that's where the air pocket would be, especially if the eggs are like a week or so old. You have an air pocket there, so you wouldn't actually be breaking into the egg itself.
Peter,
good idea.
Thank you so much for that call. Yeah, we're always racking our brains trying to figure out what will get people to call into the show, David. Turns out it's the best ways to peel hard-boiled eggs. Who knew? Well, I think you had one more recipe for us. Here it is. Baked eggs in hash nests. Again, we've put this up at wpr.org/foodfriday. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, another one where you use the oven. I like cooking using an oven because you set it up and then you go away and you come back and all of a sudden there's your meal. Basically, this is as simple as it gets. You can use a can of hash, make it into a couple of little nests, and spread it evenly, put some little depressions in it. You could poke it with a cup or something just to make that. You break an egg into each of the depressions, and you bake for 375 for 30 minutes, and then you have a meal. Pretty easy, is that? Now, here's a nice variation. I was going to make that not long ago. I didn't have any hash, but I had hash browns. Ooh. Did the exact same thing, made the little nests. In fact, they looked more like real eggs and nests. Cracked it in, put it in the oven, baked it, and I had a delicious hash brown and egg dinner just waiting for me.
Well, it seems like you could do that with a lot of different forms of potatoes anyway. I could see, like, you know, you make some mashed potatoes and then you lay it out and drop the eggs in them too.
Well, the fun of this, of putting this book together, and I think also of using it, is that there's a lot of variations you can think of. It's not like you must do this exact thing this exact way. It's really a kickoff point to say, hey, well, I could try this or try that. And the instructions that I've put in here, too, are really step-by-step. So even a person who knows nothing about cooking can probably figure their way through it.
Let's bring on one more caller. Conrad is with us in Ashland. Conrad, hi.
Hi. I had a question on egg production. We have about 20 chickens. And in the summer, we usually get about a dozen eggs a day. And then the winter, it drops off to one or two a day. And we do have a light in there that we put on at night, but I wondered if you had any suggestions for increasing production in the wintertime.
Conrad, thanks for the call. David, he's got a bigger scale operation, it sounds
much
like, but
bigger.
Any advice? Yeah.
Boy, that's dropping off a lot. I'm not sure. We did discover one thing, that the food that we give them makes a difference on egg production. We had been just using a real basic food for quite a while, and one of our hens was getting pretty old and had stopped laying eggs, and we switched to an expensive GMO food for a couple of months, and that old hen started laying again.
Hmm.
So that might make a difference.
Experimenting with food.
Are your eggs being free-ranged? Are your chickens?
Yeah, in the summer. They don't like going out.
Oh.
I have a feeling you're going to find eggs behind trees and things, too.
All right, that's all the time we have. Conrad, thanks for calling in. And David, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us and your recipes.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
That's David Tank, author of Uncle Egbert's Egg Book and caretaker for a backyard run of chickens. We talked with him for this edition of Food Friday about cooking with eggs. He joined us in our studio in Eau Claire. Coming up after the news, we'll get the latest on this morning's impeachment vote and then what happens next in Congress. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, for those who are deaf or hard of hearing, catching up on post-game news typically meant following along with closed captioning. Now for Milwaukee Bucks fans, they'll be able to follow the post-game press conferences with an American Sign Language interpreter who joins us on the show coming up. First, after a marathon hearing last night that ended without a vote, the House Judiciary Committee made its final decision this morning on articles of impeachment.
Today is a solemn and sad day. For the third time in a little over a century and a half, the House Judiciary Committee has voted articles of impeachment against the President for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The House will act expeditiously.
That's Jerry Nadler, a Democratic representative from New York and chair of the House Judiciary Committee, delivering the news to reporters about the vote. The decision today makes President Trump the fourth president in the U.S. history to face a possible impeachment. The vote was along a party line, Democrats voting unanimously to pass both counts, Republicans all voting against the articles. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer for The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back with you, Rob.
Well, it's an unusual time on Capitol Hill. What's the feeling there after this vote this morning, really kicking this impeachment process into high gear?
Well, a lot of bad feelings, and we've seen that for the past several weeks between Democrats and Republicans as this impeachment process has gone on. That being said, I think there were no surprises here. I think we all knew that this was heading towards this type of finish at the end of the year. The House of Representatives on Wednesday, it looks like it will formally bring these articles of impeachment to the House floor, and vote on them. There are two articles, as we know, abuse of power and obstruction of justice. And much like it was on the Judiciary Committee votes today, this will, for the most part, be a party line vote. We are not expecting any defections from the Republicans. Everybody is lining up behind President Trump and the Republican Party. We are expecting only a handful of defections from the Democrats who will be voting no against some of these articles of impeachment.
Let's take a quick look at both of those charges we heard here on Wisconsin Public Radio, the actual hearings over time, and then the back and forth yesterday. Abuse of power, sum up that charge for us.
Yeah, I think the abuse of power, and you know, this goes to the broader debate over what these articles of impeachment should have looked like. There was a lot of debate about whether you go big or you keep it narrowly focused in recent weeks. And Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats decided to keep it narrowly focused to the Ukraine matter. And so abuse of power has to do with, you know, this idea, this charge by Democrats that the president was using the power of the presidency to solicit interference from Ukraine in the 2020 upcoming election by withholding aid and withholding a visit to the White House to the Ukrainians. And so that really is what the abuse of power charge looks like. The second charge is obstruction of Congress, and that simply speaks to the president's assertion that no one from his administration was to cooperate with the Democratic impeachment investigation. And we saw, for the most part, many of the White House officials and many of his cabinet members, like Mike Pompeo, like Mick Mulvaney, the White House chief of staff, not agreeing to testify or provide documents to the Democrats. On the other hand, you did see a number of career Foreign Service and intelligence officials come before the public hearings and also sit before in private depositions and take part in this impeachment process.
In addition to the substance of the two charges, the two articles of impeachment, there's been a lot of argument over process, including late last night, Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee not pleased about closing debate without a vote last night, waiting till this morning. Here's a listen, starting off with House Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler again.
I want the members on both sides of the aisle to think about what has happened over these last 2 days and to search their consciences before we cast our final votes. Therefore, the committee will now stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., at which point I will move to divide the question so that each of us may have the opportunity to cast up or down votes on each of the articles of impeachment and to let history be our judge. The committee is in recess.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman. There was no consulting from the minority ranking member on your schedule for tomorrow, in which you just blown up schedules for everyone. You chose not to consult the ranking member on a schedule issue of this magnitude.
So typical.
This is the kangaroo court that we're talking about.
Closing there with Republican members of the House Judiciary Committee, including ranking member Doug Collins of Georgia. Talk about that moment, Scott.
Sure. There were a lot of gasps in the room. People had expected that the vote would be held last night, or actually earlier in the evening around 5 o'clock, because a lot of the Republican lawmakers wanted to get to the White House Christmas party hosted by President Trump that he does every year for lawmakers. But in fact, Republicans continued to offer amendment after amendment. Those amendments, which were all voted down because Republicans are not in control of the majority, but you know, those amendments, everyone had 5 minutes to speak on it, and so it just went later and later into the night. Finally, Jerry Nadler, the Democratic chairman of Judiciary, made a determination with his team that rather than try to hold these votes in the dead of night, that he would just adjourn for the day and do it in the morning. Once they made that decision, they voted very quickly right after 10 o'clock Eastern and passed those articles on party line votes. But again, it just sort of goes back to this idea that impeachment really has torn the Congress apart and divided the government right before the holidays.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill, looking at the latest in the impeachment process. The impeachment is likely, as you were saying, going to pass the House. But then there's the Senate, where the trial would actually be heard. Senate Republicans saying it's probably not going to go very far. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had this to say on Fox's Sean Hannity show about the proceedings.
And everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this to the extent that we can. We don't have the kind of ball control on this that a typical issue, for example, comes over for the House. If I don't like it, we don't take it up. We have no choice but to take it up, but we'll be working through this process, hopefully in a fairly short period of time, in total coordination with the White House counsel's office and the people who are representing the president in the well of the Senate.
There's been criticism from Democrats there, Scott, saying, wait a minute, the Senate is in effect the jury for the president, and they're consulting, they say, very in total coordination, he said there, with the White House.
Exactly right, and it's spurred criticism from progressives like Pramila Jayapal in the House of Representatives, who has called for Mitch McConnell to recuse himself in light of some of those comments. But obviously, this is a political process, and this is why the president has wanted the impeachment process to move quickly through the House and head to the Senate, where he will be on much more favorable terrain. And what Mitch McConnell has said, I don't know if it was today or yesterday, he said there is zero chance that the president is going to be removed from office. And so, this cake is sort of baked already, although it's going to be a very interesting trial and certainly a historic one. We haven't seen one of these in two decades, not since Bill Clinton. So people in the Capitol are still very eager and interested to tune in to this Senate trial. There are a number of questions that are still up in the air at this point, including whether witnesses will be called to testify in this trial, whom those witnesses might be. Really, President Trump is calling the shots here, him and his White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, who has been coordinating very closely with the Senate Republicans. And they are hashing some of those questions out as we speak.
With this being an election year coming up, 2020 elections, a lot of people seem pretty sure they know exactly what the political impact of these impeachment proceedings is going to be. It's going to be devastating for the Democrats. It's going to hurt President Trump. Is there any way to tell at this point what this is going to mean come Election Day?
I don't think so, especially since people tend to, especially under this president, there seems to be so many controversies. I remember before the 2018 election, everyone thought the government shutdown was going to be a huge factor in the outcome of the 2018 election. And so much had happened since then that nobody really was talking about the government shutdown by the time the election rolled around. And so what we're seeing right now is from the very vulnerable House Democrats who are freshmen who won races last year or unseated Republican incumbents, they are, for the most part, rallying behind this impeachment effort. A number of them, including Tom O'Halloran of Arizona, Connor Lamb of Pennsylvania, Max Rose of New York, came out with statements just today saying that they will be voting for these two articles of impeachment. Yes, they will be pummeled on the airwaves over this impeachment vote. Republicans think this is a very good issue for them, and so they are spending a lot of money on TV and Facebook ads hammering these Democrats. But these Democrats are pointing to other work that they are getting accomplished, including passing prescription drug bill this past week, getting key provisions in the Defense Authorization Act. The House will be voting on the USMCA trade bill, which both the White House and these moderate Democrats will be touting. And so, it's still, like you said, it remains to be seen what the overall impact will be from this impeachment process.
As we wrap up, Scott, what are the key moments to watch for next week?
Well, it's going to be a little bit of a split screen. The key votes that will be happening at this end of the year pileup will be preventing a government shutdown, the impeachment of President Trump, And then finally, the passage of the USMCA in the House. And so what Democrats have done is they have sandwiched essentially the impeachment on Wednesday in between government funding and this bipartisan trade deal, and in hopes of sort of they don't want the last vote of the year to end on impeachment and to play Scrooge and leave a bitter taste in people in Americans' mouths right before the holidays. And so the last vote of the year, it looks like, will be on this bipartisan historic trade deal, North American trade deal, that both the White House will be celebrating as well as moderate Democrats.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Scott Wong with The Hill. He covers House leadership there. He joined us for a look at the impeachment vote in the House Judiciary Committee and what happens next. Coming up, we'll talk to the latest addition to the Milwaukee Bucks, their American Sign Language interpreter. We'll talk with them about their role and how it could impact people with hearing disabilities. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. How do Wisconsin voters feel about impeachment and the 2020 Democratic presidential field? We'll look at the results of the newest Marquette University Law School poll coming up. Now, the Milwaukee Bucks made a recent addition to their post-game news conference lineup, an American Sign Language interpreter. Since late October, Bryce Christensen has stood by Bucks coach Mike Budenholzer at home games and interpreted the post-game news for Bucks fans with hearing disabilities. Christensen is the first ASL interpreter for a professional sports team. Bryce joins us now to talk about his work and the service the Bucks are providing here. Bryce, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, before we get to the Bucks, how did you first get involved in ASL interpreting?
Well, ASL is actually my first language. Both of my parents are deaf, and I'm the firstborn. And so for the first couple years, I really, not to say I had a deaf experience, but both my parents being deaf and being exposed to American Sign Language, I didn't have any other siblings around me at that time. So growing up, I interpreted for my parents, and then never really realized that I wanted to be an interpreter until I got into my 20s, and then really realized that I enjoyed that interaction working with deaf patients in a hospital. And that's when I decided to make that change, and I attended UW-Milwaukee, their interpreter training program, graduated from there, and I've been interpreting now for about 6 to 7 years.
Now, for people who don't speak ASL, what are some common misconceptions about it?
For those that use American Sign Language, I think the biggest misconception is that I would say maybe terminology. There are a lot of, not to say offensive terms, but I would say more archaic terms such as hearing impaired. They don't consider themselves a disability group, and I completely support that. They are a linguistic and cultural minority that is often misrepresented, and it's a legitimate language, American Sign Language. And I just think that a lot of people look at it as more of a gestural language when it actually is a bona fide legitimate language.
Right. I think sometimes, and in the past I had thought this, that American Sign Language is just like a code version of English, and that is not the case, correct?
It's completely opposite of English. It has a different structure and syntax, but it has all the parameters of a language linguistically that comprises of American Sign Language.
And I understand even before you were involved with the Bucks, you sometimes interpreted sporting events for your parents.
Yeah, actually, that was one of those things growing up, sports being a big part of my father's life. And then he wanted to instill that in me. And so growing up, we attended a lot of sporting events. I wouldn't say that I interpreted the entire games, but definitely different, I would say, different moments that my father wanted access. And then it's interesting to see it go full circle and now being an interpreter for the Milwaukee Bucks.
Talking to Bryce Christensen, the American Sign Language interpreter for the Milwaukee Bucks and host of the Unknown Packers podcast. Bryce, what brought you on board with the Bucks?
Really, it's been a connection that I've had for about a year and a half, and the connection started with Kieran Nolte, who is the vice president of Arena Experience. He was my point of contact for performance interpreting with the Fiserv Forum, and within Fiserv Forum, I had done concerts and other performances, and we had met up for lunch, and he wanted to see how we could increase accessibility and visibility with the Milwaukee Bucks as well as Fiserv Forum, and it's something that's always been on my mind is how to sort of really changed the definition of access. And access is always looked at as a request basis. And I just think that it's a fundamental right for humans to have communication and language access. And so I threw a Hail Mary, maybe the different sport, and just to see what he thought of this idea, this proposal. And he went to President Peter Fagan, who then went to Coach Mike Boonholzer, and they were all on board. And I think it speaks volumes of the classy organization that Milwaukee Bucks are, the strong connection that I've had with them for a year and a half, to really create this almost bizarre, unique proposal. And it just feels natural. It feels right so far.
Now, you mentioned the Hail Mary. Sports has a lot of metaphors. And it seems like for a translator working in any language, those metaphors are going to be tough to tackle in real time. What kind of challenge is it to translate sports jargon?
Sign language interpreting is a humbling profession, or it should be for sign language interpreters. And I think that's the beautiful thing about the profession, is that language evolves and language changes, and especially with something that, I mean, I'm accustomed, even though my first language is American Sign Language and my parents are deaf, I'm still hearing. And so I navigate with an auditory language and now also with a visual language as part of my profession, as well as interacting with family and friends. But I think the biggest challenge is just the unknown, is what terms, what terminology is going to get thrown out there that maybe I'm familiar with and maybe I'm not. And a great example was the New York Times article about Giannis Antetokounmpo being a monster. And that was the first real challenge of, okay, I can definitely converse using sports ASL terminology, but there's other metaphors like monster, Hail Mary. How do I make that visual? How do I interpret that? And so always reflecting on the work, I have a couple deaf consultants that I work with to try to improve my interpretation and also keep myself grounded.
Are you hoping this idea catches on in the sports world to bring more, whether it's the post-game interview or analysis or whatever, more accessibility in ASL?
That's the hope. And really, it's more of just looking at the landscape of access. And I just feel that instead of it being a request basis, it should just be provided, and figuring out how we can do that. And I think the post-game interview with the Milwaukee Bucks is just scratching the surface, and not only with professional sports, but in all entities where maybe we can raise the bar and how can we provide more access, more communication equity with the deaf and hard of hearing community.
You're also the founder and co-host of what I think that New York Times article said was the only English and ASL podcast that discusses the Packers. Can you talk about that podcast?
Yeah, so my first love, if any Milwaukee Bucks people or fans are listening, my first love has always been the Green Bay Packers, and now the Milwaukee Bucks have definitely got on the same wavelength, definitely on par right now. But I've always loved talking sports, and the Green Bay Packers has always been a passion of mine, and I found I needed a hobby, and so I created the Unknown Packers podcast with another friend of mine. And then that was where I started looking at, well, I have deaf friends, I have deaf family, my profession is sign language interpreting, how can I provide this in American Sign Language? And so we started doing interpreted podcast episodes, and then I brought on a good friend of mine who's well-versed in NFL, football, and Green Bay Packer terminology, who's deaf himself, and I wanted more of a deaf experience, a deaf perspective. And so what we do is he provides his own analysis on the Green Bay Packers, and then I also provide a transcript, notes to send to him that he can incorporate into his own episode. So it's a hybrid of the episodes that we do in spoken English that are then interpreted into ASL by my co-host, if you will, Jason Altman, who is deaf. And then he also provides his own insight in American Sign Language as well.
All right, you're working with the Bucks. You've got this Packers podcast. Do you have future sports plans in ASL and or English?
Yeah, it's like I mentioned, it's been really humbling, and being on Wisconsin Public Radio as well as being featured in the New York Times, it's definitely something that I did not envision when we embarked on this. This was just something that was always about access, and with my parents being deaf, I have close friends who are deaf. I just want them to have the same amount of access and experience that the majority of society experiences as well. And so my hope is that we continue to increase and spread awareness for communication equity, the recognition of a bona fide and legitimate language in American Sign Language, and then also the humbling profession that is sign language interpreting. But I foresee some greater things happening, not only with the Milwaukee Bucks, but hopefully the NBA and other sorts of professional sports arenas.
Bryce, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor.
That's Bryce Christensen. He's the American Sign Language interpreter from the Milwaukee Bucks and the host of the Unknown Packers podcast, the only podcast available in American Sign Language and in English. He joined us from our studio in Milwaukee. Check out that Unknown Packers podcast wherever you get your local podcasts. What comes to your mind as we count down toward holiday season in December? How about green sunfish, silver lampreys, or freshwater drums? That might not be your holiday countdown, but they do show up on one researcher's annual online Advent calendar, the 25 Days of Fishmas. Notre Dame PhD researcher Katie O'Reilly started the tradition a few years back, combining her love of freshwater fish and her habit of making puns, that's according to a report in the Great Lakes Echo. She profiles a different Great Lakes area fish each day for 25 days straight on Twitter using the hashtag 25 Days of Fishmas. Today, December 13th, we meet the green sunfish. Here's some fun facts quoting from the Twitter feed. It's part of the Lepomus genus of fish. They're sunfish, a group whose members are commonly called bream, or they say, if you want to upset a fish biologist, perch. While native to the Great Lakes and Mississippi River Basin, the green sunfish has been so widely introduced, it's now present in nearly every U.S. state. And this is seasonal. Like a holiday shopper who knocks others out of the way at the department store, the green sunfish is known for being a bit aggressive. When someone's on their turf, they flare their gill flaps to make themselves appear larger. Quoting there from the 25 Days of Fishmas Twitter feed. Well, share your favorite freshwater fish with us. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Celebrate the season. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.